Father Gannon these two red barrettes snagged with long brown hair that she'd been carrying like red-hot embers in her apron for days since first discovering them in his pants pocket. Hearing a sound now, she tiptoed to the door, a little woozy with the turbulence of sweet cologne in the dim hallway. "Father Gannon!" she called as the back door opened. He smiled as she hustled into the kitchen. He was freshly shaved, his cheeks high with color. His dark eyes glistened.
"Kate, I didn't want to disturb you, but would you make sure I'm up for the 6?
"Where are you going?"
she snapped. Her chin quivered. In all her years here, not a single priest had ever called her Kathleen or Kathy, much less Kate.
"If the Monsignor asks me, I don't know what to say, especially at this hour."
"Oh, Kate, I'm sorry. That really puts you in the middle, doesn't it?"
He glanced past her to the dark stairs.
"I haven't wanted to say anything. You know how the Monsignor feels about politics, but I really like Jack Kennedy. They meet over in Woodstock, his committee, that is, and there's not much I can do to help during the day, so at night..."
"Of course," she whispered, a finger sealing her lips. "Of course, that handsome young senator and his beautiful Jackie." Waving, she shooed him out the door. He had to say no more. Naturally, an energetic young priest would want to do all he could to help elect the first Catholic president, even if it meant dragging around dog-tired all the next day. She had to admit, it gave her a little thrill, the thought of him defying the Monsignor. Father Gannon was every bit as courageous and rugged as Senator Kennedy himself. She opened the trash basket and tossed in the barrettes. My Lord, all these days of worry, and they probably belonged to some child, and him like a child himself in so many ways. She stood by the window, smiling as she watched him go down the moonlit path. Must have broken a few hearts when he got the call. Her own heart stirred. It was a fine and noble life, this selfless giving to God.
"Now what the devil's he doing?"
she muttered, startled to see him kneel by Howard's perennial bed and cut himself a bouquet of Shasta daisies and baby's breath. Mooney finally had a job. He was driving a truck for J.C. Coulter and Sons, which was the biggest tire distributor in the state. He was on the road 4 days out of 5, hauling threadbares up to Burlington for retreading. It wasn't just any zombie steering job, either, since he had to load the truck himself here in town, unload up at the plant, then reload the return shipment of retreads. Plus, he was responsible for all the paperwork, every invoice and bill of lading, each of which had to be date-stamped and signed at both ends of the run. He carried all the forms in a green plastic folder attached to a clipboard he'd bought himself. Getting into his truck in the morning, he could almost hear the drum roll, the chorused voices heralding another successful mission. He smiled a lot more often. The old swagger was back. He wore his soft green collar up, and now, with his hair all grown out, he was cultivating just the slightest swell at the base of his sideburns. He bought himself brand-new hand-tooled cowboy boots and cigarettes by the carton, which he kept locked in his trunk along with every other possession. Not that he was afraid Anthology would steal from him, so much as that it continued to make staying with his cousin seem like a temporary arrangement, one that could change at a moment's notice. "Any calls?" was still his first question through the door. "No calls, no telegrams," Anthology always answered back. In some illogical way, it began to seem that this job was the special assignment, the lie becoming not only a force, but a possibility for redemption. Coulter didn't pay big money, but he'd assured Blue the job was his as long as he delivered on time and didn't get in trouble with the law, which included any kind of traffic violation as far as Coulter was concerned. Like every other prospective employer, Coulter had questioned his brief stay in the Marines, but he was the only one who'd accepted Mooney's explanation without question. All he asked was to be notified the minute Mooney received his assignment, its covert nature thrilling the old man, a former leatherneck himself.
"Yes, sir,"
Mooney had answered, as he did now to all of Coulter's orders, which continued to mitigate Coulter's initial misgivings. It was not kin or rumor that gauged a man's true worth, but performance, Coulter had said, looking him straight in the eye. "Better dead than red," proclaimed the decal on every truck in Coulter's fleet, and every uniform had an American flag sewn on the sleeve. Mooney was proud of his new uniform, with his name scrolled on the pocket flap in orange thread. Blue, plain and simple, like the dark green pants and shirt, securing him in the ranks of like-minded men. Tonight, before he picked up Anthology at the A+X, he stood his collar straight up, turned his shirt cuffs back just one fold and set the wave in his hair one more time before going inside. He followed Alice from the storeroom into the kitchen.
"I saw your school today, your college, that is," he said.
"That's good," she said, hurrying back into the storeroom for straws. Wisps of hair had slipped from her ponytail and lay on her collar. He blew a quick puff of air, grinning as the little hairs riffled up and down. She glanced back at him.
"I go right by it," he said,
returning quickly with her to the kitchen.
"Hey, maybe I'll stop in and see you when you're going there."
Her head shot up and she opened her mouth, and her cheeks flared red, but she only took a deep breath.
"If I can, I mean. There's no telling how busy I'll be then, and you too," he added quickly.
"Yeah, I probably will be," she sounded relieved. "Especially at first."
"Yeah, especially then."
A month, he thought. He'd give her a month, then he'd stop by and see her. Maybe take her out in the truck to eat someplace nice. By then he'd have plenty of money. He'd buy her a present, maybe a book or a megaphone or whatever it was college girls liked. While she finished her chores, he sat on the counter, smoking a cigarette with Coughlin. A few minutes later, a car pulled in at the back of the lot and doused its lights. Taking off her apron, Alice ran outside and climbed into the car. Mooney looked down as the car passed under the order window. It was him again, the priest. Alice's head was lowered to smell the flowers she was holding. The priest's car was in the distance as they pulled out of the lot.
"Guess where they're going?"
Anthology called, as he strained to see over the dashboard.
"Jesus, he's a priest," Mooney said.
"Yeah? And what's he picking her up this late for? To pray?"
Mooney shrugged.
"They're friends. He's a priest."
"Oh, they're friends. But the priest is plugging her, believe me, I can tell."
He held his breath. Anthology was baiting him. They'd really been getting on each other's nerves lately. His cousin liked it better when Mooney was completely dependent on him.
"Need butts?"
he asked, slowing as they came to the gas station where Anthology usually got them from the machine.
"No, let's follow them. Come on," Anthology said.
Saying he needed cigarettes himself, he pulled next to the air pump. But he already had a full deck in his pocket, Anthology protested.
"Come on," he squealed, pointing ahead. "Look, they went through the lights right past the church."
"He's taking her home," he said as he got out of the car. "Down to Edgewood Street."
"Holy shit!" Anthology hooted out the window. "You even know her street!"
When he got back in, he closed the door hard, then backed up and shifted forward with a jerk to remind Anthology of his status here.
"I get any calls today?"
he growled as they peeled down Main Street. If Anthology said one more word about Alice and the priest, he was afraid what he might do to him.
"Like always, no calls, no telegrams," he laughed. "Hey, let's stop for coffee,"
he said as they came to the Silver Diner at the bottom of the hill. They hadn't stopped in since Blue had started work. Anthology loved coming here on their way home.
"I can't, I'm tired."
He gave it just enough gas to race them by the diner. His cousin looked back at the diner and then up at him.
"You know something, Blue? You're turning into a real prick. You don't want to do nothing anymore, not with me anyway."
"Look, I've been on the road all day and tomorrow I gotta be up at 5.
It felt so good saying it, he couldn't help smiling.
"Hey, I want to ask you something. How come you got a job if you're still in the Marines?"
"I told you, you're supposed to."
"You're supposed to what?"
"You're supposed to do that when your cool down's up."
"Cool down? What's a cool down?"
"Come on, don't," he warned. "I told you so much I shouldn't have already."
Like Coulter, Anthology enjoyed the intrigue of his secret mission.
"So what? You tell me one more thing, big deal. What am I going to do, go tell another spy or something?"
Mooney laughed.
"I'm not a spy. I'm a Marine that's waiting for orders."
"Okay, okay. So what the hell's a cool down?"
"That's when you cool down."
"Yeah?"
Anthology persisted.
3 months, you cool down. I've been out 3 months,"
he said, exasperated that Anthology couldn't comprehend such an obvious concept.
"So you cooled down, and now you're what? Cool?"
"Yeah, you know, as far as in civilian terms, that is, cool. Not all, what do I want to say, not always acting like a soldier all the time."
He glanced over, his smile fading with the amusement on Anthology's face.
You're full of shit, and I hope you know I know that, okay?
I do know.
I do,
Anthology said softly.
Yeah? What the hell do you know?
Anthology grinned.
I know you're not waiting for any special assignment. This is it, isn't it? What'd they do, throw you out?
His laugh was high-pitched and grating.
Come on, Blue, it's me, Anthology. You can tell me.
They didn't throw me out.
What? You quit? You couldn't take it? What happened, pretty boy? Someone muss up your hair?
Shut up, you little freak.
Hey, I don't care. I'm just sick of your shit, that's all. Thinking you're some fucking soldier of fortune all the time or something.
He jammed on the brakes, hurling Anthology against the dashboard.
Get out. Get out of my car.
I'll get out. I'll get out of your fucking car. And you get out of my fucking apartment.
His stubby arms and legs churning, Anthology scrambled onto the side of the road.
I'm out. Consider it done.
He roared off. This road led straight up into the flats. Mooney's radio played softly, the spill of its pale glow on the seat, the car's only illumination. He thumped the steering wheel and tried to sing with the music. His voice cracked and the words trailed off as he thought of what Anthology had said about Alice and the priest. He remembered the little church in Cuttingsville his mother had taken him to once a long time ago for some uncle's funeral.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be my way,
he yelled out the open window, as he sped over the dark, winding road past uncles and cousins and more distant kin, to the three narrow chicken coops he used to tend, and now his mother let stand empty, rotting into the black loam. And a little farther on, here, her brown cottage and lush garden, vegetables, when it was flowers he wished for her. And there, from its post by the road, the bug light's sickly glow puddled out from the yard into the road, yellow as beer.
No,
he muttered, then said it again as he reached up and unscrewed the hot bulb. Just as he put it into his pocket, the porch door squealed open.
Put that light back on, his mother called. You hear me? I said put that light back on.
She charged down the steps, holding her bathrobe closed.
It's just me, Ma, he said. Blue.
What do you want? What are you doing out here? She demanded.
I told you, Ma, don't be doing this anymore. I'm making good money now.
Well, you make your money and I'll make mine. She held out her hand. Now give me that bulb.
Let me move back, Ma. Please.
I said give it.
I could be paying you room and
give me the bulb.
Ma, I haven't been in one bit of trouble since I've been home. You know I haven't. I wouldn't pick a penny up off the ground if I found it. I'm so careful. I drive careful. I walk careful.
He said with almost painful longing.
All I want is good things now. That's all I want, Ma. Honest to God.
Good things. Sweet air in his arms, this uniform ironed every day, pants creased, and his own money in the pockets.
Then how come you're here? How come you're not still in the Marines?
I am. I told you. I'm waiting for orders, that's all.
Travis!
She laughed and shook her head.
You're just like Kyle. You're nothing but trouble, and I'm sick of trouble. So give me the bulb. Give me the goddamn bulb.
Here's your bulb. Here's your bulb. Here it is,
he bellowed, whipping it at the side of the house. The tiny glass pieces glittered as they drifted down through the night. All day long, Marie had been filled with dread, with this sense of catastrophe looming. On her way to work this morning, she'd almost hit a boy on a bike. Then no sooner was she at her desk than Mr. Tuck called, looking for his fee, which she promised to send right out. He asked if Benji would be able to come tomorrow afternoon, because it seemed clear he needed to be seen more than just weekly. She said Benji wouldn't be coming again.
Oh dear,
Mr. Tuck said with a catch in his voice. Benji wouldn't be coming. He was fine now. The session obviously snapped him, too, she lied. She had to keep reminding herself that this idiot's wife who'd thrown her son out of her house was Mr. Briscoe's niece.
Well, remember, with the slightest relapse, you'll be sure and give a call.
And then, at 3 o'clock, Renee called. The minute she heard his voice, she felt sick to her stomach. Had the bank discovered the discrepancy in signatures and contacted him? But he only asked if she'd heard from Sam. Sam? What did he mean, hear from Sam? All Renee knew was that Helen had just told him to call and ask after the hospital had called her. Why? What was wrong? Was Sam all right? Renee didn't know.
But I think so,
he said,
because Helen was mad. She was so mad.
When she got home, she found the overdue notice on her first loan payment in the same day's mail as the bill for Alice's first semester at UVM. At the table now, Omar was fanning himself with one of the torn envelopes. His collar rim was dark with sweat.
I can't understand the delay, he said. They promised delivery 2 weeks ago, and I even covered the newest franchise orders out of my own pocket and paid the freight myself to make sure this wouldn't happen.
But it has, she said, pacing between the sink and the table. It has happened, Omar. So now what do I do?
Stay calm, he said.
Stay calm, she cried, slapping her sides. She wheeled in a little circle. How could he just sit there? Stay calm? I could lose this house.
I'll take care of it, he insisted. I told you I will, and I will.
Then here, she held out the red-stamped bank notice.
Believe me, he said, sliding it into his breast pocket. This is the last time you'll ever see this.
I can't have them contacting Rini. Oh, God, I can't believe I did that. What was I thinking of? I mean, that's forgery, isn't it? That's against the law.
She couldn't recall thinking anything at the time, only feeling, for the first time in years, actually feeling something deeply.
Marie, I'm going to say it one more time now, and I want you to listen carefully. As soon as the soap comes, you will be so busy selling your product that all these worries, all these fears, will seem like a bad dream.
A chill went through her, and with it, the image of Sam's clammy hand groping toward hers to seal another oath, another promise. Reaching from his bed, from a dark corner, promising never to have another drink ever in his whole life, assuring her that someday this would all seem like a bad dream. She folded her arms over the cluttered sink and stared out the window.
Marie?
He got up and stood next to her.
What is it?
She closed her eyes and bit her lip.
Tell me what you're thinking right now.
That I've gotten myself into a horrible mess. She looked at him. I'm trapped. I'm stuck. I'm really, really stuck.
No, you're not, he cried. You're not stuck. You're not trapped. You're rooted, Marie, wonderfully, and I know sometimes painfully rooted. But look at all you've got, a home, a family, a job, a town you've lived in all your life, everything I'd give my right arm to have.
Her eyes filled with tears. She shook her head, as struck by his passion as by his naivete. The wonder was that he could continue to believe, to have so much faith, so much trust. Didn't he see what was happening here?
You're a pioneer,
he was saying, flinging his arms in the greasy supper air. She had fried ham steaks in this dented pan on the counter. Discs of the white fat floated in the soak water.
The first of a new age, he was saying. A woman as strong and as fearless as a man. No, stronger even than a man, because you need neither man nor woman. You are a woman without guile or excuses.
His eyes gleamed. He smiled, panting a little, not so much to catch his breath, she realized, as to fuel the dwindling flame. I'm a pioneer, all right, she muttered. She turned on the water. It had to run a good 5 minutes to get hot. Astrid had a brand new dishwasher. Last week, Astrid had left her husband, had gotten as far as Albany before he caught up with her, and now she pushed buttons to clean her dishes.
A pioneer, she sighed.
Yes, and believe me, Marie, someday there'll be more of you, women who can stand on their own 2 feet.
These are awful tired feet, she sighed.
Here, he said, reaching toward the faucet. Let me do them.
No, I'd like you to do something else, Omar. I'd like you to call Roy Gold, right now, in front of me, she said, looking at him.
Apparently, he knew Gold's number by heart.
He was halfway through dialing when he abruptly hung up.
I've got to admit something, he said. I've been calling all week, and I keep missing him, so don't be disappointed. He's a very busy man.
He started to dial again. Frowning, with his eyes closed, he asked for Mr. Gold. He looked at her.
Mr. Gold, this is Omar Duval, he said, grinning and pointing at the receiver. Roy, yes, of course, yes. Well, it's my orders, sir. I've got all kinds of anxious distributors here waiting for their soap. Well, I know. Yes, sir, I can appreciate that. You're just so busy, just out straight, business is so good.
He winked at her.
Just fantastic, you say? Well, I'd certainly appreciate your doing that for me, sir. You see, there's this one very special distributor that's...
Yes, he said, nodding.
Yes, she is. She's right here, as a matter of fact, sir.
Here, he said, holding out the phone.
He wants to tell you himself.
The voice on the line was reassuring and pleasant. Gold apologized for the company's two-week backup on deliveries, and he promised to do everything in his power to get Omar's orders out immediately.
These things happen when it's a product everyone wants. And not only that, but a merchandising concept that's just all of a sudden now catching fire. Believe me,
he said.
You'll be glad you waited, because you are getting in on the ground floor of the fastest-growing company in America.
Thank you, she said. Thank you so much.
She handed the phone to Omar.
Yes, sir.
Omar was glowing.
She feels much better now, and so do I, sir. So do I.
A few minutes later, she was sitting at the table watching him wash the dishes when the phone rang. It was Sam. Right after lunch, he'd walked out of the dining room, out the front door, he said, out of Applegate and onto the highway. He'd hitchhiked most of the day to get here.
Here?
Home. I'm back home, pet. And this time, everything's going to go right. You'll see.
Sleeves rolled up. Omar was humming. He winked as she sat back down at the table. It was Alice's day off, and she and Joe were driving toward Albany, looking for some out-of-the-way restaurant where no one would know them. This was the first time since the trip to Applegate that they had been together during the day. In the early afternoon light, he looked much older than he did at night. His face was already dark with stubble and, like his mood, grim. The Monsignor had caught Joe sneaking into the rectory Monday at 1 a.m. His excuse had been a Kennedy for President rally in Bennington. There wasn't much the Monsignor could say after last week's letter from the bishop urging clerical support of those candidates whose positions would be in the best interest of the church. But for the next two nights, Joe played it safe and stayed home. This morning, when he told the Monsignor that he'd be working all day in Albany on a telephone pole for Kennedy, the Monsignor complained about his mileage. He said if it kept adding up the way it was, he would have to bring the car in again for a tune-up to that crook Archetti, who felt he could charge top dollar just because Archetti footed the bill for the altar lilies every Easter. Alice had missed Joe these last 2 days, and now all he could talk about was the Monsignor. She yawned and smoothed her skirt over her knees. She hated these tirades. It didn't take much to stir him up. He could go on and on over nothing.
And then, just as I'm leaving this morning, you know what he said? He said, no stickers, Father. The heat just glues them on the car forever. And don't forget, he said, we have some very important Republicans in this parish. And then you know what he said? He looked at me in that judgmental, that critical, that sarcastic way he does, and he said, and I think that you of all people, you more than anyone, would have learned by now, Father Gannon, that a good priest is apolitical.
It confused her to see him so agitated over something that wasn't even true. Kennedy was just an excuse for them to be together, and here they were, together. She moved closer and smiled.
Every time I think of it, I see red. I can't believe he said that to me.
He banged the steering wheel. Said what? Had she missed something? She tried to listen more closely.
He's had it in for me since the day I came.
There was a catch to his breathing, like a pant or a ragged little cry.
A good priest is apolitical, is he? No, a good priest keeps his mouth shut. A good priest doesn't think. A good priest doesn't feel. That's what he really means.
He kept glancing at her.
That's what he wants. Ears and a mouth. That's what they all want, you know? Maybe he figured I'd been lobotomized or something.
He laughed so suddenly that she laughed too, then squirmed in the mirthless silence. For the next few miles, neither one spoke. She twisted her purse strap miserably as he brooded over the road's curving glare. He was so emotional, so volatile. This intensity she'd first sensed in him made her as uneasy now as it had then. There was too much power here, too much energy for one so used to fleeing it. She felt as if she were being crimped smaller and smaller, like a scrap of paper the air might at any moment seize through the open window. She wished she hadn't come. Maybe it was better at night when they were tired, when all they could do was hold each other.
"There's one,"
she said, pointing to the little white restaurant ahead. Even the crushed stone in the parking lot was white. She read the sign, White Cottage, relieved when he said he was starving. Maybe he'd be in a better mood now with all that off his chest. She waited while he locked the car. He put his arm around her, and she leaned against him as they came through the parking lot. It must be awful, she thought, having to listen to people's problems all day long and never be able to share his own with anyone. Inside the bustling dining room, his gloom returned, so she tried to do most of the talking. UVM had sent her information about her dorm, her academic advisor, her courses. She even knew her roommate's name. She still hadn't decided whether to get the linen service or not, and she had to let them know soon.
"But whenever I bring anything up, my mother says, 'Not now. Wait until the soap comes.' That's all she talks about now. When the soap comes, when the soap comes. God, she thinks her whole life's going to change when the soap comes."
"Don't be so hard on her. Maybe it will," he said, making her feel childish and petty.
Bristling, she carved off a small piece of steak. She hadn't been criticizing her mother, just trying to keep the conversation light. There was so much she wouldn't burden him with. Her father's escape from Applegate, her mother's crying herself to sleep every night because Omar hadn't been around in days, and her own terrible guilt. Last night she'd dreamed that she was kneeling at the rail waiting for communion. When the priest came to her, she closed her eyes and held out her tongue, but instead he gave the host to the person next to her. "Wait," she called softly, "you skipped me." He looked back in disgust, and she saw that it was Joe.
"That's just the way my mother was about my going into the seminary," he was telling her as he began to cut up his entire steak.
For a moment, she wasn't sure what Presto Soap and UVM had to do with his going into the seminary. Suddenly, she wanted to tell him that she hadn't gone to Mass in weeks. She wondered if he would tell her it was a mortal sin.
"You know, I don't think she ever had one single moment or accomplishment or person in her whole life to be proud of until I went into the seminary. Right away, I knew it was different for me than for the others, but I kept fooling myself. I kept thinking somewhere along the line, I'm going to change. I'm going to find exactly what God wants me to do. I thought it would come like wisdom, you know, this enlightenment like a tongue of fire over my head. I waited for it. I actually did."
He laughed, and she felt a little better. He chewed and talked and gestured with his fork all at the same time. He really had terrible manners, but at least his mood was improving. Maybe he just needed a chance to talk about himself.
"My first parish was in this little mill town in upstate New York. I said Mass, I did the novenas, the evening catechism classes, I visited the hospital and the nursing homes, I went by the parish school once a week. And still I had all this free time, all this energy. So I asked the principal for a group of troubled kids maybe I could help. I took them on hikes and picnics and played ball with them. They were always at my door. Winter came and there was this one kid, this runt named Radlett, who was wearing sweaters because he didn't have a jacket. So I bought him one, fleece-lined with a hood and buckles all over the place. No other kid had a better jacket, let me tell you, than Radlett had. The other kids picked on him for it. Radlett's mother told me to mind my own business that she could get her kid a jacket, which, I guess, caused trouble with her and her husband, because one night he got drunk and said he'd punch me out if I ever laid another queer hand on his kid. Pretty soon Radlett wouldn't even look at me. His life had become so miserable. Next thing I know, my pastor's accusing me of buying the jacket with the priest's birthday party money. It was gone from the jar, $25. I was transferred. I couldn't figure out how one kind act could brand me a pervert and a thief. This must be it, I told myself. God's testing you, that's all. He's getting you ready for that tongue of fire. Later, that pastor wrote and said he'd found the birthday money after all. I was exonerated. At least I wasn't a thief.
Again, his laughter rang with bitterness. Each piece of steak seemed to take longer to chew.
My next assignment was the Bronx, in a crummy, beat-up, lousy neighborhood like the one I grew up in, only worse. All the kids were Radletts. Most of the young priests in that parish hated it. Not me. I was so happy I thought I was going to cry that first day. It felt like I was trembling all over. I thought, this is why the crazy Radlett thing happened. This is what God wants. I got right to work.
I got stores to donate their day-old bread and bruised fruit to the needy, and I delivered a lot of it myself. I wrote to some seminary buddies in rich parishes and had their parishioners send their old clothes and shoes to our parish. The rectory basement started looking like Macy's, people going through the bundles and trying things on. But that's where the trouble started. They said it was in direct competition with the Bishop's Relief Fund, that I had no business running my own clothing drive without going through proper channels. I was told to submit my requests in writing on the proper forms directly to the Chancellery officials. So I did, but all I got back were these polite notes saying how the needs of our parish would be met as soon as other parishes ahead of us on the list had gotten their share. I tried to accept that. I'll be patient, I told myself. Then a letter comes saying there'd been an earthquake in South America somewhere and all the clothes had to be shipped there. My parish would be on next year's list. And would we, by the way, take up a special collection that Sunday for the suffering disaster victims in Bolivia? Okay, I said to myself. I even read the letter at one of the masses. He had stopped eating. Then winter came. An awful winter. People were heating their tenements with their oven doors open 24 hours a day because the landlords kept the building thermostats locked at 60 degrees. He leaned over the table and looked at her. She swallowed hard. There was this one woman, he said, his voice falling to a whisper. She wasn't much older than you, with two babies. She came to me crying. She showed me her gas bill. $60 for 1 month. I told her I'd get the money for her somehow. While I was begging around from people I knew, the gas company shut her off. Her 3-month-old baby got pneumonia and died. Sure, she should have gone to welfare. Sure, she should have taken the baby to the hospital, whether she had the money or not. But she was one of those that just didn't know how to make things happen. She went crazy, and she tried to drown the other baby. So they put her away and sent the baby to a foster home. He rubbed his face in his hands. There seemed to be silence at every booth and table. That's awful. At least there's nothing like that here, she said, but he didn't seem to hear her. That's when I took my first real look at the polite and pious and obedient Father Joseph Gannon. I started visiting every apartment in the neighborhood, Catholics, Protestant, Jews, it didn't matter. It took me 2 weeks, and what I saw made up my mind for me. I knew if I did nothing but pray for these people and go through the charade of proper channels, then I was no better than their landlords. I mimeographed leaflets calling for a rent strike until the thermostats were turned up, until the broken windows were replaced, until the holes in the roof and the walls were patched. A lot of the landlords, the big ones, the ones who had 5 or 6 or 10 of these hovels, reacted by turning the thermostats down even lower. So I went out and got blankets. I asked for blankets everywhere, from stores, the Salvation Army, Goodwill, hospitals, my fellow seminarians again, even my own rectory. I took every extra blanket and tablecloth I could get my hands on, even old drapes from the attic. Word got around, and 3 other priests joined me and a nun. We set up a kind of relief station in the parish hall. We passed out I don't know how many blankets. We had soup and coffee for them when they came and cookies for the kids. We wrote letters to the papers. It looked like a couple of the smaller landlords were coming around. But then 3 of the biggest landlords, and 2 of them were Catholic, went to my bishop with checks in hand. They convinced him I was disturbed. The nun was a communist, and the other priests were drunks. I was put in a hospital in New Mexico for a month.
He looked at her.
I wasn't there a month, Alice, but a whole year. They said I had a nervous breakdown. I don't remember much of it, besides crying a lot.
He sighed.
I certainly did cry. I stayed in one little room and wouldn't go outside for months. I never saw the sun or the rain. I didn't want to know anything.
She moved the peas around on her plate, remembering Marlin and his breathy questions, and her father pressing the flat white box into her hand, and her mother's bitter laughter at such a gift for their only daughter, their firstborn child, whose conception had seeded a marriage and disaster.
I wanted to tell you, he said. I thought you should know.
She nodded.
Can't you say anything?
I'm sorry, she whispered. Why was he doing this? Why here, with all these people around?
I don't want you to be sorry, he said irritably. I want you to understand.
I understand, she said, as cautiously as if she were extricating the very bottom piece from a jumble of pickup sticks, because, as always, to blink or take a breath might bring her father lurching through that door, might fill this quiet place with her mother's prayerful entreaties that were as bitter as curses. Sweet Jesus, help me. I beg you, please help me. Didn't he know how fragile it all was, how precarious the balance?
You see, it wasn't Radlett or rent strikes or blankets I needed, Alice. It was you. I love you, he said fiercely.
Shh! She stiffened and did not dare look away from his rough face that glowed with sweat.
This is what God wanted for me. I know that now. Love.
The waitress was coming. Aren't you going to finish? Alice tried to ask, but he kept on talking.
All this time, I thought I'd lost my faith.
Excuse me, the waitress said with a toothy grin.
She reached for Alice's plate and asked if they were done.
No,
Joe said so sharply that the woman's hand jerked back. Alice's face reddened, and she stared miserably at her plate as the waitress moved to the next booth. She could feel them all turning, looking, listening.
But now I realize that my faith has become a wholeness. It's a unity of mind and soul and flesh,
he said, taking her hand in both of his.
I finally feel like a real priest.
On their way down to Hankam, Mississippi, a hose blew in the old green station wagon. They taped it up, but they had to keep putting water into the radiator every couple of hours. A nice white lady gave them 2 1-gallon mayonnaise jars from back of her hot dog stand. Luther kept them filled with water, their sloshing almost unbearable for Montague, whose own plumbing was so bad Luther had to stop about every half hour so the old man could pee. Like all their troubles, past and to come, this, too, settled into the flux, fueling the rhythm, so that the minute the car pulled over, the old man would open the door, turn a ways, and relieve himself into the dusty road weeds. The old man said he wished there was some kind of internal replenishment between his output and the leaky radiator, and Luther said maybe he could fix it so the old man could piss straight into the radiator hose from the front seat. Replenishment. That was one of Montague's favorite words, to put back what had been taken out.
Replenishment.
It played through his thoughts night and day like the fragment of an ancient hymn.
Replenishment.
It was a hunger beyond flesh.
Replenishment.
He had not eaten a meal or slept a moment since they'd lost Early. Not once. Oh, his eyes might close, but he was painfully, doggedly awake. The little money they had came from the few Bibles they managed to sell along the way. Luther would wait in the car while Montague shuffled house to house, his soiled satchel bulging with the plastic-sealed Bibles, and in his palm Early's worn photograph, fondled now to the softness of cloth.
My only living relative,
he would cry before they could shut the door.
I'm a tired and sick old man and ready to die, but I can't do it alone. I need to be mourned and prayed into heaven, and this is the only one I got to do it, this here handsome young man.
Luther said the first thing he was going to do when they found Early was beat him to a pulp. Every day the old man had to endure this idiotic reverie, although the closer they got now, the less he minded it. He liked to recall the good times along the way with Luther and Early sparring just for the hell of it. He remembered how it made him laugh and how it got on Duval's nerves.
"Gonna twist his arm up tight behind his back," Luther was muttering. "Gonna say, why'd you do that? Why'd you dump us like that, Early? Tell me now, why?"
Montague knew. He knew why. But Luther would scoff, insisting, no, that wasn't it. If anything, a woman's swelling belly would be enough to keep Early from ever going back. But the hunger had grown so strong with the deepening heat that Montague knew that in Hankam they'd find Early and Lady with their newborn child. She'd already missed a month when they left, which was why Early had been so quick to jump at Duval's offer. All expenses paid, and a chance to see the country, while he parlayed a small investment, his army savings, which he'd just handed over to Duval, not a paper or a note signed, into a sizable nest egg. Montague had begged the boy not to do it, but Early was determined. His child wasn't going to grow up poor as him. This was his big chance, and he wasn't about to turn his back on it,
especially when a man of Duval's caliber had such faith in him.
Why'd you run out on us with Duval's money, Early? Come on, Early.
Luther's head bobbed over the wheel away from the imagined jabs.
Tell me, Early,
he grunted, grinning with his vision of revenge. Well, 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 here they finally were, mayonnaise jars sloshing and the hunger boring a hole in Montague's gut all the way down Hankham's main street. But Lady and her family were gone, having moved 3 times just in the last 6 months, the problem mostly being work for Lady's father and that slew of children wrecking every place they got. It took a while longer, more driving, tracking down relatives, last jobs. With so much sodden tape on the hose, Luther had to strip it off and start all over again. And then had come the day at last when here she was, Lady Dwelly herself, grinning through the rusted screen with the prettiest baby in her arms, the cream-colored image of its daddy. A tiny girl, Lady had clear skin, big bright eyes, and a soft little nose that squished against Montague's chest. He hugged her so tight for so long, the baby started to cry between them. He let go, and she gave a squeal as she looked past him to the young man springing up the steps, and he was grinning too, as he turned so fast he wobbled dizzily, then grabbed her shoulder to steady himself. But it was Luther. Only Luther. Luther, eager for his revenge, if not on Early, then on someone. Clearly, it was not going to matter. Luther was swearing, and the three of them knew, and it was right then that Montague's heart started breaking off into chunks that floated through his bloodstream. Even now, weeks later, he could still feel them throbbing throughout his body.
"He ain't here," she said.
"But he's coming. He's coming,"
he insisted with the urgency of the wheels that still seemed to be rolling under him.
"He started back such a long time ago. Be a month by now. Maybe 2.
It was hurt rising, pure hurt like a wall around his brain.
"End of May," said Luther. "Beginning of June."
"He ain't been here," she said, her whole face twitching. "I can tell you that."
"But the boy said, he said Early told him. He knew your name and he knew Hankham, Mississippi,"
Montague insisted.
"The boy lied,"
Luther said, and kept saying all the long way back, every time he brought it up, puzzling over the particulars of the boy's tale that day, for instance, Early's generosity, especially when it came to kids, and Duval's money clip, silver with a fancy D engraved on it.
"Now how'd he know a boy like that, just coming along the street?"
Montague would muse in his need to hone it all to a simple and unobscured gleam of light he could keep in the distance. The reply was inevitable, its voice dark and tired.
"Duval told him. He lied for Duval." "I don't know. That just don't add up." "Don't make me say it, old man, don't."
Well, it was a long way back, a long way still to go. Always low on money and gas, they were burning oil in a long black tail. Luther scowled over the wheel. Weeping, the old man had collapsed at Lady's feet. Certain he was dying, Luther had carried him like a baby into the car. The old man started begging and gasping, and then his eyes rolled back to whites, and Luther couldn't stand it any longer. Yes, yes, he had finally relented.
They'd find Early. "Something must have happened. I know that,"
Montague sighed. It was as much as he'd admit. He was still not eating or sleeping, and now barely taking liquids to cut down on the stops.
"Yeah, something happened, old man. Something evil. Something named Omar Duval's what happened."
It was that hour late in a summer afternoon when the stillness rose from the tree-lined streets like quiet from a well. It was the time when the calls often came. Her fingertips stained a fragrant green, Jessie Klubach knelt on the thick warm lawn deadheading orange marigolds. She tossed the faded blossoms into the forsythia where Harvey wouldn't see them. The compost pile was in the corner of the yard, and way back there she might not hear the phone ring. The dog was buried next to the compost pile. That poor dumb dog. She didn't miss him a bit. Of course, she'd never admit it to Harvey, but she enjoyed gardening so much more now without the dog slobbering all over her and charging down the driveway, barking whenever anyone came up the street. and it was such a relief not having to endure Marie Fermoil's abuse every time she caught him in her yard. Yard. Jesse had sometimes felt like shouting back, "You call that weed-filled, junk-strewn eyesore a yard?" The house was a mess with its peeling paint and missing shingles. The garage roof was so sway-backed with rot that Harvey had long ago forbidden Lewis to ever go in there. The neighbors were disgusted, and a few had even threatened to speak to Marie Fermoil. Someone really should, she thought, or better yet, maybe they could all get together for a community fix-up, like in the old barn-raising days. Harvey had been horrified when she told him this. Marie Fermoil didn't want anyone's help, he said. People should just mind their own business.
Well, we could at least offer, she persisted, aglow with the images of men on ladders, scraping and hammering away in the hot sun, while the ladies scrubbed windows and planted flowers from their own lovely gardens. What would be the harm in that?
I couldn't begin to tell you, he sighed.
That's what I mean, Harvey. You, of all people, you know what that kind of life is like. How can you not help?
You don't understand, Jesse. Sometimes the best you can do is to not make things worse, he said.
She didn't understand, but she knew enough to drop it, with him anyway. That was the difference between them. Life was too short to be passive. She started by calling Cynthia Branch across the street. The Branches and Marie Fermoil had not spoken since the night Cyrus fired his rifle into the air to scare off drunken Sam Fermoil, who was beating on Marie's front door. When the police came, Marie told them Cyrus had been shooting at her house, and he was charged with discharging a firearm within town limits. Jesse had explained to Cynthia what a boost this would give Marie. She said she couldn't imagine having to do all that Marie did on her own, and it could happen to any one of them. Who knew what the future held? They had to help one another. Wasn't that what life was all about? Especially the women. Then Cynthia interrupted and, choosing her words carefully, said she and Cyrus would be glad to do anything that would improve the bleak view through their picture window. Next, she called the Wilbers, who were always complaining about Marie's unraked leaves blowing into their yard. Without a second's hesitation, Sandy Wilbers said she and Jim would be there. Judy Fossey said she'd plan all the food. And beer, they laughed. Plenty of beer to keep the hubbies happy. Dick Fossey, with braces on his legs from polio, would be clerk of the works. It was up to Jesse now to pick a day when Marie would be away. It would have to be a surprise. Something like this was bound to make a difference, not just for poor Marie, but for everyone. The screaming that went on over there was so depressing. It was toughest on Harvey, who'd grown up in a house like that, the trauma of which had kept him single until he was 40. Jesse thought it symbolic that she'd met Harvey in a waiting room. She'd been waiting for her mother to come out of the doctor's office, and Harvey'd been waiting to go in. After years of painful joints, his knuckles had begun to swell so much, there were some days he couldn't close his hand around his butcher knife or pull the trigger on his rifle. Before they met, Harvey's whole life had been long days at the Meadorama, with just about every weekend spent up at his camp. Now, with a wife and child, he only got to the camp a few times a year. Last spring he'd taken Lewis, but they had to come home a day early. Everything had frightened him, snakes and spiders, moonlight shadows and raccoons prowling on the tin roof.
Skittish,
Harvey had said, lip curled, disappointed, as if his son had somehow failed him, when the poor little boy just wasn't used to sleeping out in the woods like that. It was the closest she'd ever come to disliking her husband. Their worst arguments had been in June, when Lewis began crawling into their bed every night, convinced that bad men with knives were trying to climb through his windows. Harvey wouldn't let Lewis go over to the Fermoils after that. Not only was Benji too old for Lewis, but something about the boy had always made Harvey uneasy. He said sometimes when he was working outside, he'd look up and find Benji watching him, which Jesse understood completely. Benji was a lonely child without any men in his life, and he enjoyed watching Harvey work. It was probably some kind of novelty for him. But Harvey had been adamant. Whatever the kid's problems, he wasn't going to have his son traumatized by them. She had to admit Lewis was happier now that he was playing around the block with children his own age, but she felt terrible seeing Benji alone so much. The poor kid had lost Lewis's companionship, and then the dogs. Well, at least she and Harvey were getting along better now. Lately, their most sensitive topic was deciding how to invest the money Jesse's mother had left her when she died last year. In the last 6 months, Harvey's worsening arthritis had engendered a score of panicky schemes. They'd move to Arizona and buy land. They'd stay here and breed Cocker Spaniels. He'd build a greenhouse onto the back of the house, and they'd raise orchids for florists. She knew their wisest investment would be to buy the meat-a-rama from Mr. Gilder and hire a butcher to do the work Harvey had done for the last 30 years. But each mention of it only mired him in days of gloom. She hadn't brought it up since the morning he discovered the dog's crushed body in the lilac bushes. They'd heard doors slamming across the way, and Marie Fermoyle yelling, and then Norm's pitiful bellow, a wounded howl, as outraged as it was contrite. Harvey had been at the table with his face in his hands. "This isn't right. Someone has to do something," she'd said, heading for the door. "Things can't go on like this. It's just not right. It's not fair to anyone."
"No," he'd pleaded, gesturing her back inside.
"Don't, don't," he'd whispered, as if he feared being heard, "because that's the worst thing. That's the worst thing of all." Later, when Harvey was filling the grave, Omar Duval had hurried across the driveways offering to help. But by then, there was little left to do. When Duval had first come, she used to feel a little thrill seeing him go in and out of the Fermoyles. She liked to think of Marie falling in love, softening, relenting. In the scenario she played out, Marie wore clingy nylon dresses and bright red high heels. Jessie would do her dishes, gazing at the neglected little house, her knees trembling as she felt the intensity, the passion of Marie's submission after so many years of loneliness. Jessie had done her best to make Duval feel welcome in a neighborhood where he was so clearly out of place. People were always asking her about the stranger at the Fermoyles, the riverboat gambler, Cyrus Branch called him. At first she'd been intrigued by the white suit, the dark shirt, and the slicked back hair. Now he gave her the creeps. In conversation he always stood with the close, unblinking scrutiny of someone examining a painting for the flaw only he knew existed. That morning, Harvey had leaned on the shovel, talking to Duval for a long time over the gouged lawn. Watching through the door glass, she had the strangest feeling that if she looked away, something might happen. When Harvey finally came inside, he couldn't stop talking about the brilliance of Duval's new merchandising operation. It just made so much sense, one of those ideas that's so simple, so obvious, people don't think of it. She kept washing the same countertop while he told her this was it, the opportunity he'd been looking for. But they had to be careful. Duval said they weren't to breathe a word of it to another living soul. She felt a tightening in her chest. Harvey said he could finally be his own boss and set his own pace. What about buying the meat-a-rama? She asked. He'd be his own boss there. He shook his head. Didn't she get it? Didn't she understand? He needed more out of life than a little butcher shop. All his life he'd been afraid, afraid of the unknown, afraid to take a chance, afraid what people would say, what they might think. Didn't she remember asking him once why he couldn't go out of his way a little to help Benji Fermoyle? The truth was, he could barely look at that kid, because it was like seeing himself, not just then, but now. Scared, always scared. Well, he was 49 years old, damn it, and he was sick and tired of being scared. The phone was beginning to ring inside the house now. She wiped her hands on her apron. She got up slowly, taking her time, for if she rushed, if she appeared too eager, then she'd be disgusted with herself. She closed the door and took off her apron. She looked at the phone as it continued to ring. If she got it, she got it, whoever he was. "Hello?"
"I've been thinking about you."
His husky whisper gave her goosebumps.
"What do you mean?"
She looked around uneasily, even though she knew Lewis was still down the street.
"I've been thinking of kissing you. All day long I've been thinking of that."
"Oh."
She had to clear her throat, her eyes closed.
"I guess you haven't had a very busy day then."
"I keep thinking of putting my mouth all these different places on you."
"What do you mean by that?"
"Well, first I start with your feet."
"My feet?"
"Yeah, your toes. I put my..."
Each part that he named tingled. His breathing was heavy in her ear. Through the window now came another man's voice.
"Attaboy, attaboy. Eye on the ball now. Here it comes. Nice and easy."
She sighed. It was the strangest feeling, this low voice churning waves of heat through her body while, blurred beyond the window screen, a priest kept throwing a ball to Benji from Oil, who could not catch it. Finally, the priest called out that this time the ball was going to hit him, so he'd better not miss. Benji caught it.
"That was great!" the priest whooped and clapped his hands. "That was really great!"
"And then,"
gasped the voice,
"I carry you up the stairs, and I put you down on the nice white sheets."
It was almost closing time when a tap came at the office door. Marie Fermoil looked up from her typewriter to see Cleveland Hines peering in at her. He had just dropped Ferdinand Briscoe off after a chamber executive meeting, and since he was passing by, he thought he'd just pop in and say hello. She nodded. Omar had made her first loan payment, so that couldn't be why Hines was here. Her throat went dry. Rini's signature. Oh, God, that must be it.
"So, how are things?"
"Fine," she gulped. "Things are fine."
"And the family?"
He cleared his throat uneasily. "They're fine, too." This was so humiliating. Oh, God, she wanted to die. He stepped all the way in now and closed the door. His silver hair shone above his deep tan.
"Where's your compadre?"
he asked, gesturing at the empty desk. "Astrid's part-time. She only comes in 3 days a week." He smiled.
"Well, that's nice. Makes things a little more private."
He laughed.
"She's certainly a tinsely kind of gal, isn't she? Not my type."
She tensed as he picked up her stapler and clicked it a few times, catching the staples in his palm as they fell.
"I've always admired you, Marie. I mean, really admired you. I hope you know that."
She held her breath, preparing for the accusation. Once an admirable woman, she was now a fraud. He put his hand on her shoulder.
"Do you know what I'm saying?"
"No." She lied into his elegant blue gaze. She would not blink or look away. His hand seemed to sink into her flesh, its weight deep inside her bones. "I will never do it again," she wanted to say, but was afraid she would start crying.
"Tell me something. Do you like to dance?"
"No, I don't."
"Would you ever consider having a drink then, just the two of us?"
"I don't drink."
"Oh, you're much too virtuous, Marie."
He laughed and slipped his hand away in a fragrant breeze past her face. "I'm just busy, Mr. Hines, that's all," she said, attempting to roll a fresh sheet of stationery into her typewriter. Her hands were shaking.
"Not so busy that you've forsaken all of life's pleasures, I hope,"
he smiled. "Just the ones I don't need," she said, then began to type. Date, address, salutation. She felt trapped.
"Well," he said, "I'd best be on my way."
He opened the door, then turned back.
"By the way, how's the rumpus room coming? I saw Rini the other day, but I forgot to ask him. Are you pleased with it?"
She stared up at him, her fingers still striking the keys. At the mention of Rini's name, all color had drained from her flesh.
"Maybe I'll stop by and see it one of these days. Make sure you and the bank are getting our money's worth." "Take care now," he said with a wink, then closed the door.
"Rumpus room, rumpus room, rumpus room, rumpus room, rumpus room," she had typed across the line. Robert Haddad turned over the envelope, another warning from the Home Office on all the unpaid premiums. If they didn't receive payment in 10 days, the policies would be canceled, and he would be ruined. He dropped the envelope into the wastebasket, then stared out the window at the bar, rankled by the unfairness of all that cash just rotting away in Hammy's cellar. If he could only get back down there, his troubles would be over. But immediately after the break-in, Hammy had had thick iron bars welded across the cellar window. Everything had gotten so complicated. Might as well just go home and tell Astrid the truth. Soon everyone would know the terrible mess he was in. At the sound of a car pulling up out front, he backed his chair into the shadow of the file cabinet. He could see the dented front end of Sherman Bloom's new Pontiac Bonneville. He'd promised Sherm his insurance check for the accident 2 weeks ago, but then he had to use the money for Astrid's new furniture, her red and silver dinette set, and her Hollywood bedroom suite of blonde ash.
"God damn you!"
Bloom called as he kicked the locked office door.
"You no-good bastard, you lying son of a bitch!"
Finally, Bloom got into his car and drove off in a rattle of loose parts. There had to be a way, he thought, watching the barroom door flash open and closed across the street. First shift from the wire plant was getting out, and the men were stopping at Hammy's for a quick one before heading home with their empty lunch pails and grease-stained shirts. Not one of their wives had a glass-top dressing table and a heart-shaped mirror framed with lights. Why couldn't Astrid be content with her life? She was going out with her girlfriends practically every night now, and it was tearing him apart. There was nothing he wouldn't do for her, nothing he wouldn't give her. The phone began to ring. He stared at it for a long time, then picked it up, answering in a high, feminine voice.
Haddad Rifko, how may I help you?
Is Bob Haddad there? This is Sam from Oil calling.
He rolled his eyes.
Mr. Haddad is out right at the moment. Sorry.
Okay. Look, when he comes, you tell him I don't want any insurance. I just want the money back I paid him.
Fermoil said.
That would require a notice of cancellation, sir, he said sweetly.
The last thing he needed was Fermoil barging in here.
Well, then, that's what I want, a notice of cancellation, then.
No sooner said than done, he piped, holding the phone close as he scrawled his pen across a sheet of dusty paper.
There. All I need now is, $50 for the notice of cancellation. He couldn't believe his own resourcefulness.
$50?
Fermoil cried.
Look, miss, you don't understand. I just got out of the hospital and I don't even have 50 cents. That's why I want the money back I gave Haddad. I'm trying to get a job and I need money, you know, for decent clothes and things so I can look presentable.
I'm sorry, sir, but that's our normal procedure.
Can't you take the 50 out of the money I'd be getting back?
Fermoil pressed.
Absolutely not, sir.
So, in other words, I'm stuck with an insurance policy I don't even need.
Not something you need, sir. Something your children need, he said in his sweetest voice.
What they need right now is money. Look, you tell Haddad I'm coming.
I told you, sir. Mr. Haddad's not here, he interrupted, lips pursed. I'll certainly tell him you called, but as I said, unless you bring in $50 for the notice of cancellation, your policy is absolutely ongoing and irreversible.
Christ.
Fermoil sighed.
I can't get a break anywhere.
Some days are like that, Mr. Fermoil. Believe me, I know, he said softly.
Well, thanks anyway. You've been very helpful, and I appreciate that, miss. I really do.
Well, thank you, sir. I'm just doing my job the best I can,
Haddad said, staring out at Hammy's with what he realized must be the same desperate longing this poor bastard felt for booze. When Alice got up at noon, Benji was eating a peanut butter sandwich and drinking Kool-Aid in front of the television.
Father Gannon called, he said, without looking away from the screen. He said to tell you the time will be the same.
He glanced at her.
He's not coming over here again, is he?
No, it's about this, what do you call it? This thing he's doing, this campaign, I think he said. He's working on it. She kept clearing her throat. Her face felt hot. Joe had popped in on her yesterday. When he saw how much that upset her, he tried to act as if he'd come to see how Benji was doing, to throw the ball around in the backyard. Joe had to shoot down every one of Benji's excuses before he had finally gone outside with him, and then Benji had been miserable the whole time. He'd been embarrassed that he couldn't catch the ball. Joe had found Norm's glove hanging in the garage, but Benji refused to put it on. It had been painful to watch. Last night after work, she told Joe he was never to come here like that again. A commercial came on, and Benji hurried into the kitchen to put his dish and glass in the sink. Black ants were running over the countertop, their quarry a bowl of bloated cornflakes. He grabbed the insecticide and sprayed, then watched them curl up, dying in the glistening, oily slick.
That was bright, she said. Now everything's covered with spray. I had to kill the ants. Mom said they're in the walls. They're all over the place.
They probably are, she said with a bitter laugh.
They were in the tub this morning, and she started to cry.
That's not why she was crying, not over the ants. It's Duval, that's what it is. God, I wish he'd just go. It almost seems like he's got some power over her or something. She shuddered.
I don't know. Sometimes he scares me.
He was staring at her.
What do you mean?
I don't know. It's like he's just waiting.
Waiting for what? He whispered, his face white. She tried to change the subject, but he persisted. What did she mean? Waiting? Waiting for what?
She explained that it was just an expression, waiting, like trouble waiting to happen. She turned on the water and rinsed the dirty dishes. She was starting to feel that way about Joe, as if there were some pressure building in him, some imminent eruption.
Alice!
What? She asked, surprised to see him still there, biting his thumbnail. He kept opening his mouth, then sighing.
What is it? You can tell me. Come on, Benji, tell me.
Nothing, he said, so miserably that she turned back to the sink. She was afraid it was about Joe, who was calling daily now. Sometimes it almost seemed as if he wanted people to find out about them. Last week, with her in the car, he'd dropped off a saw at St. Dominic's for Father Krzysztofski, who walked Joe out to the car.
You remember Alice Vermoyle, he'd said, touching her arm, causing Father Krzysztofski to blush as much as she was.
Benji's show was starting. He raced back to the couch. Last night, Norm had told their mother Benji should at least go to the pool. Even if he just stood there, Norm said, at least he'd be getting some fresh air. At least he'd be around other kids. There were only so many battles she could fight, her mother had answered. She barely had energy for anything lately. Haggard and heavy-eyed, she came home from work exhausted and often went to bed right after supper. Duval hadn't been around in days. They didn't dare ask, but they were hoping he was gone for good. Alice wrung out a wet rag and started to clean up the bug spray. The fumes turned her stomach, so she opened the window. Mrs. Klubach was hanging clothes on the line, gazing up with a little smile at the Vermoyle house. Mrs. Klubach had been her Girl Scout leader in the sixth grade. When all the other girls in the troop were given application forms for summer camp, Mrs. Klubach told Alice that she'd spoken to the director about letting her go free because of her family situation. After that, Klubach became a family code word. You were being Klubacht when someone acted as if he wanted to help, when all he really wanted was to nose around in your dirt. After she washed the dishes, she went in and sat next to Benji. He glanced at her and smiled.
Hey, Benj, you never told me what Mr. Tuck said.
He shrugged, his eyes never leaving the screen.
Just that I was simulating about the accident, that's all.
What's simulating?
Making believe it didn't happen.
What else did he say?
That's all. Then I had to go.
Do you do that? Do you simulate?
Well, do you?
She asked, annoyed by his glassy stare. He shrugged. A commercial came on.
I don't want to talk about it, okay?
Thinking this might be the thing he'd been trying to say, she persisted.
Benji, you really liked that dog, didn't you?
Eyes on the television, he nodded.
You miss him, huh?
Sometimes.
And you must be blaming Norm, but it's really not even his fault. I mean, he shouldn't have been drinking, but the thing is, he didn't know the dog was there. It was one of those things, like fate, when everyone's in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Benji, she gave his arm a little tug.
Come on, Benj, talk to me.
He shook his head.
They say when bad things happen, the best thing is to talk about them. Otherwise, you have all these feelings, all this pain bottled up inside. Benji, you know what I mean?
He nodded and took a deep breath.
So come on, talk to me. Tell me what you wanted to say in the kitchen.
Come on, she said, playfully scratching the top of his head. She thought she heard him gasp. Eyes closed, he sank against her. The room seemed strangely full of the television, the pattern of flickering light and shadows it threw across the floor, the voices, the sputter, the laughter, the jangle, all gave her this prickly feeling of being on the outside looking in on all that was real. They both looked up as someone began to knock on the door.
Please open the door,
Omar Duval called.
My arms are full.
Omar's back,
Benji said, grinning. He jumped up and ran to let him in. After dinner, Marie tried to sort through the bag of pamphlets and forms and promotional packets that Omar had brought. The first step was organizing all these materials before the soap came. When? Any day now. Could he be more specific? In a day or two. Tomorrow? The next day? When? Her second payment on the loan would be due soon. He was on the telephone now, explaining to one of his distributors that he'd just come from Connecticut, where he'd finally laid it on the line with gold.
There were to be no more delays. Too many people were counting on him. In Atkinson alone, he had 15 distributors clamoring for their product. She looked up. 15 distributors in Atkinson alone? The table was covered with glossy green pamphlets and forms and order slips that had to be stapled together. When the soap did come, they could be quickly attached to each box and bottle of detergent. It would take her hours, but she wanted to be ready. Nothing would be left to chance. Omar chuckled softly into the phone. As soon as he hung up, she asked how was she supposed to sell all her soap if half the people in town had their own lifetime supply. Not to worry, he chided. It was the investment that counted. He had been over it and over it with her, and she still couldn't get it straight. Why couldn't she trust him, he wanted to know. She did, she insisted, but she needed to understand how it worked, this pyramid that kept piling up riches, stuffing her pockets with money. It was like a chain letter, he tried to explain. She had never understood chain letters either, had usually been the one to break them, had never been able to believe that anyone could get something for nothing. But it wasn't something for nothing, he insisted. She was forgetting her investment in a product she would sell, a product that would induce her customers to invest in their own franchises. So it always came back to the investment. Yes, yes, yes. For him, it made absolute sense. The investment was the constantly growing base, pushing her higher and higher up the ladder. But it just didn't seem logical, not with everyone selling the same thing. But they're not, he said. It only seemed that way. It must be her, then. She couldn't get it straight. Something was missing. Faith, he said. Trust. Those were the missing pieces. At some point, she had to give herself up. She had to yield and let the process take over. She began by separating the forms and order blanks and triplicated receipts that were all mixed up in these grocery bags. Some of the forms were soiled and dog-eared, and many were sticky from spilled soda. Mr. Briscoe had taught her that neat paperwork was the backbone of a business. Everything at your fingertips. Proof. Copies. Norm came into the kitchen and watched sullenly while she sorted the forms into piles. Earlier, when he'd asked her to go out with Weeb, she had told him no. He could stay home and give her a hand. A few minutes later, Benji came in and stood looking over her shoulder at all the papers. "Who's going to sell all the soap, Mom?" he asked. "Are we going to do it like we did the Christmas cards?"
"Uh-uh," Norm said. "That's not what you're thinking, is it?"
He stared as she tried to explain it to him. "And word just spreads that you've got the soap, that's all. People just find out you've got it, and they come to buy it from you." He looked at her incredulously. She heard her voice weakening. "It sounds crazy, but Omar says it's selling like wildfire in 38 states already. It's a different kind of soap. It's..."
"A detergent theory based on the principles of jet propulsion, young man," Omar said, returning to the kitchen. "A product of the future."
He stood behind her, kneading her shoulders.
"How come nobody's ever heard of Presto soap before?" Norm asked with a peevish squint.
"I never heard of it." "And is to be ignorant, to deny existence? I think what we have here is a fine kettle of philosophical fish," he said, with a wink down at Marie. She tried to smile.
"All I know," Norm said, "is that in this whole country, if something's going to sell, people have to know about it. And for people to know about it, it has to be advertised. Who's going to advertise all this stuff?"
He pointed to the jumble of pamphlets and forms. She turned in her chair and looked up.
"He's got a point, Omar. At the store..."
"At the store," he grimaced. Marie, you know that's an entirely different operation. We've been through all this before."
"But I keep wondering how people are going to come to me to buy something they don't even know I have."
The panic in her voice registered on her son's faces.
"And something they've never even heard of," Norm added.
Omar went to the sink. There were no clean glasses, so he filled a coffee cup with water and drank slowly. Norm kept staring at him. She was staring at him. Benji was reading a pamphlet. Omar set the cup on the counter and turned back to them.
"Right at this very moment," he said, "Presto soap is being advertised all across the country."
"I've never seen any of their ads," Norm interrupted.
"You are hardly the average American housewife, Norman," he said with a forced smile.
"Well, even if it is being advertised, how are people going to know it's here, that my mother's selling it?" Norm asked.
"Because she is going to tell them,"
he said, enunciating each syllable as if for a child's benefit. And you are going to tell them. And you. He pointed to Norm and Benji.
Oh, yeah. Same as we did with the Christmas cards.
Norm smirked at her.
You want to buy some? He asked Omar. We still have most of them.
She shivered. In spite of the night's heaviness, she felt a draft at her back. I don't think that's enough, she said in a faltering voice. Just telling people. Omar moved in to reassure her.
Of course, not just that alone, my dear. There are other modus operandi.
She saw Norm thrust out his chest, and her own hand fell limply across the folders, green, the color of money, with white bubbles spelling out presto, presto, as if her luck could change with a wave of a wand.
And where do we get any of those?
Norm asked sourly, then gave her a confident nod. Omar regarded him with a pitying, indulgent smile.
Forgive me for using such technical terms, but accustomed as I am to the fraternity of businessmen, I often forget myself when I'm dealing with laymen and children. Modus operandi, Norman, are methods, ways of operating, and one that comes instantly to mind, probably the most effective, are demonstrations.
Demonstrations? She asked.
Yes, Marie. You give these soap parties. You send out invitations. People come. You demonstrate your product, offer door prizes, serve refreshments. There's even little games you can play, he said, shuffling eagerly through the leaflets. One of these tells exactly how to plan a party. Here we go. Presto parties, they're